Well, last week the world was semi-shocked that Great Britain left the European community. I was going to give a sermon last week on the subject of marriage and ended up in the last couple of days deciding that I would give one on Brexit. Probably all of us have been following that in the news somewhat because of our understanding of prophecy. I read in Life, Hope, and Truth a couple items that I thought would be worth repeating. Some of you I know would have read these too, but what came out the first day from Eric Jones was the British chose Brexit. And what he said here toward the bottom of this article was, ever since the UK joined the European community in 1973, students of biblical prophecy have watched and expected the UK to eventually withdraw or be forcibly removed from the European project. Even throughout its 43-year membership in the European community, European Union, Union, it's a community union, different names for it. United States of Europe is another name. But the British did not fully integrate, exempting themselves from adopting the euro currency and the Schengen Agreement, which abolished many of the EU's internal borders. So we read that, we watched the news, we saw what was happening, but most of us have understood that the British would not remain in the European Union since their joining in 1973 as Johnny-come-lately, because they didn't really join in the beginning. But we didn't expect it because of what we read in prophecy, what we've read, some of us, in the Plain Truth magazine going all the way back to the 1950s probably, but for me it was probably 1959, 1960 when I first read and remembered what was said, that the British would not be in the final 10 or groups of 10, because we count Benelux, three countries, as one, if that's going to be the case. So we've been watching. And I think we had, in fact, I know we had articles on the British exit. There was Mr. Eddie Johnson, along with our pastor, Mr. Hawkins, over in the British Isles, who wrote about Great Britain not being a part of the European Union. And that was written a few months ago, if some of you will remember. But I thought it'd be important to give a sermon on why England was destined to leave the European community. Now, I say England because it seems Scotland could opt to stay in, opt to first leave England by itself and opt to stay in the European Union. We already know that the Irish, the Southern Irish, not only are in the European Union but also have the euro. For those of us who traveled over there not too long ago, when you traveled down into Southern Ireland, you see the signs, which are a little different. You see two signs. You see the Gaelic and the English. But also, you go from using the pound in Northern Ireland to using the euro in Southern Ireland. So there is that difference between the two, and we've thought that the Southern Irish were Dan, and the Northern Irish were more of a Manassite, a mixture with perhaps Ephraim. But I want to, first of all, go through a book that I've used before. I think it's probably one of the best books that came out in the 1980s concerning the different European countries. And this book concerns itself with the European countries and the United States in connection with the European Union. That's why I think it's so helpful. The author was Luigi Barzini. And when you open the flap here, it says, "What then are the obscure forces preventing the coagulation of Western Europe into a solid whole as easily as liquid milk curdles into a block of fresh cheese as soon as the rennet is dropped into it? One is the apparently ineradicable survival of sensitive national prides." And then he goes on to talk about each nation having its pride in Europe, and it's not willing to give up his sovereignty to a superpower. But it goes on to say, that this author, Barzini, is one of the world's most prestigious journalists, the wisest and wittiest of Europe's chroniclers, and author of The Italians. It goes on to say, Barzini is steeped in its history and culture, that is, of the Europeans, yet affectionate but undiluted. He sees Europe that should but won't, that must but probably cannot, evolve a common will, speak with one voice, define its goals, defend itself, and pursue a single foreign policy. This book was written in 1983. You might pick this up from Amazon for a couple bucks, I would say, by this time. Most people do not see the worth of it, but we are very connected with a book like this because we know that there would be a rise of 10 nations along with a beast power, the 10 destroying Babylon and connecting with the beast, is what it says in Revelation 17. So a book like this that goes into the British attitude and their connection with the Europeans, and that's where it starts, the imperturbable British is what it says, and then goes on and talks about the Dutch, a very good section on the mutable Germans, and this is this chapter is what I've read before, the Germans, and then talking about the Italians, whose tanks all have reverse gear as their first gear, I think, is what it said, and the quarrelsome French, for example, and then it ends, of course, with what's going to happen with the Europeans in connection with the dream of a superpower being led by the Germans. And so this book is well worth reading. I don't think, again, there's a book that I've seen over the years that is so well read, actually. It's as you can see from the beginning, the author has a way with words. Some people are very gifted. So I thought I would just take a look at the British only. There's only two sections I'm going to use since the British just exited. I thought it'd be good to show you a history of the British and why they were destined for centuries not to be in the European Union. And when you see the history, not only the past, but also the recent, you can understand that they weren't going to stay. In other words, if you would have read this book in 1983, you would have said, no, the British aren't going to stay. Not from a biblical point of view, but just from, of course, we know everything's from a biblical point of view as far as the British character and their destiny, but not knowing about the Bible. The Bible, by the way, isn't brought up in this book, but you would read about their actions towards Europe for centuries and recent history, and you would say, they're not going to stay. They just won't. So let's take a look at some sections here, beginning on page 60, and this is all concerning the British themselves. But here on page 60, it starts by saying, as far as their history of past, to be sure, they always had to watch what was going on across the channel. And I think all of us know that if you had asked the British back in the 1950s, 1960s, if they were Europeans, they would say, no. No, we don't belong to the mainland, so to speak. And we're the British. They're across the channel. They're a different people. We are not connected with them. As we know, of course, the British are Israelites. And in Europe, you have a mixture of the Israelites and the Gentiles, the European the European Germans, who they would never connect with. They would never say that they were a part of the Germans. But they would intervene when necessary. And I thought this was really important because you see, they're intervening in the affairs of Europe so you wouldn't have a powerful force that they would have to contend with. When necessary, they would go over and take care of matters in Europe. And by the way, at the end of this book, when it talks about the Americans, the Europeans expect us to do that today, the Americans, except they're baffled by the Americans. They're not sure what we will do because we come into the fair so late. We're an isolationist country, as we know, and we don't get into the fray of a war World War II, for example, it was, what, 2 years before we finally entered, maybe three. World War II, 1939, 1940 passed, and it wasn't until we were attacked in 1941 that we got in. So we're not ones to intervene right away. So they're baffled. They're not sure what we're going to do. We're a little bit of a surprise to them. It goes back centuries. It says, occasionally, the British landed armies across the channel to fight Philip II, Louis XIV, Napoleon, the Kaiser, Hitler, among others. These wars cost them millions of pounds and a heavy toll in human lives, but always in the end prevented one power or another from dominating Europe uncontested. And this is what the British felt was their lot as a nation. They wanted to make sure that there wasn't one nation over there that was going to dominate. Going on, back a few pages here. When the European Union was beginning, and we won't go back all the way to the coal and steel community, as it was called, in about 1949, I forget, somewhere around there, shortly after the war. But the in 1954, there was a European idea to come together with customs, with trade, with a union that would be strong to trade with other nations of the world, only a bloc. And it looked like that it was dead. The French wanted, I thought this was interesting, the French wanted, it was said, a German army strong enough to defeat the Soviet Union, but weak enough to be kept in its place by Luxembourg. Now, if you know anything about Luxembourg, if you've ever been to Europe or if you ever looked at the map, Luxembourg is this tiny little country that I don't even know if they have a military. They're so small. It says the European defense community had looked like a way to rearm Germany, safely locked in a straitjacket within a unified European defense system. Now, that says a lot. In other words, we'll let them arm, but we'll keep them in a straitjacket so they can't do anything. Basically, the idea of a European Union was not as much for trade as it was to contain the Germans. That was the main reason. After a World War I and a World War II, you think, well, what are the Germans going to do next? They're still going to try to dominate. So the whole idea was put them together in a trade bloc, you know, in a union, where they have their own currency, they open the borders, and they become amalgamated, so to speak, into a whole, and they kind of lose their identity. Of course, we know that has not happened. But that was kind of the idea. There was an Italian foreign minister who wanted to bring the countries together, and this is where we're leading concerning the British and their attitude towards a union. This fellow's name was Martino, and he invited the British, along with several European countries, to come together and discuss trade and how they could have a common market. This was in 1954, and the British said, "We're not coming." They said, this isn't going anywhere. This is not useful at all." They didn't accept the invitation. They declined to send anybody. Just a couple years later, Martino again decided to bring them all together, this time in Brussels, and they asked the British to take part in the debates. And it says, going on, to formulate the best possible practical project. In this case, the Spock Report eventually became the foundation for the Treaty of Rome. Now, that tells you something, too, by the way, when you stop to think of of Daniel 2 and the prophecies and what happened with the Roman Empire and how you have a revival of the Roman Empire. If anybody thinks that there's not a revival of the Roman Empire and you have the Treaty of Rome, Italians not being the greatest economy in the world, of course, why would you call it the Treaty of Rome? Well, it's back to their British ancestry. Their Roman ancestry as a Roman Empire. So the Spock Report became the foundation for the Treaty of Rome, signed in 1957, which gave official birth to most of the existing EEC institutions. The British rejected the Spock Report. they rejected basically the Treaty of Rome. And in 1963, 10 years before they actually were a part of the European community, they tried to get in, 1963, about 6 years later. And by that time, it was called the Common Market, but they were rebuffed and humiliated by the French. Not surprising. You can go back in time all the way to the history of the colonization of the United States and the independence that was experienced at that time, and you see in history how the British and French did not get along. They were against each other. There were wars going on, two or three of them over a 15-20-year span, if you remember. And so the French and the British have always had problems. I think you have a Reuben who was jealous of his brother, is what's happened there, because we know both, seemingly, from what we understand, are Israelites. Going on, it says, continuing with how the British at the time looked at the European Union, said most delegations in Brussels in 1955 were headed by a foreign minister, so this is going back in time a little bit, or eminent person of comparable rank. So going to this Brussels conference that came out eventually with the Spock Report in 1957, the British sent in the early part, this was in 1955 when the delegations were meeting together, they sent a senior civil servant from the Board of Trade, while other countries sent high-ranking ministers. The British said, again, we're not going to send anybody important because this is not going to last. Going down, it said this Bretherton, the senior civil servant, pointed out that any good idea that was approved by everybody else would not please the British government and would be surely voted down by the House. One day he vanished altogether and was seen no more. Just disappeared, just left. And this fellow, Anthony Nutting, who was responsible for European affairs, of the Foreign Office at the time, said, I think it was the last and most important bus that we missed. He said, if we would have gotten on this bus, basically, we would have had the leadership of Europe if we had joined in Messina, the specific spot. So it just shows you the attitude from the past, intervene if they must. But as far as being a participant right from the beginning, it was like holding back. This is not going to amount to anything. And when they finally did get in, it was not helpful to them because it was 10 years later, and they basically lost out on the good deal, so to speak, of getting in on the beginning. So that was that English attitude. The page 59, I'll just read one more section here. Englishmen thought it was best to have as little to do with continentals as possible in the present as they had done in the past. In other words, this has been history. Have as little to do with the continentals as possible. And to be extremely cautious when they dealt with continentals. In a way, Britain still sees itself as the sceptered isle cut from the continent by divine will. And that's true. If God had wanted to tie it to the rest of Europe, he would evidently not have dug the channel, is their attitude. And don't we know? Now, how did the Europeans look, and Luigi Barzini has also, but the Europeans have looked at this small British isles. And if you go over there, they're so small that basically they use cows in the field to tell you directions. I was there for 1 year going to college there, and it was very evident that nobody knew east from west or south from north. It was just the British Isles was the British Isles, and you just go up the road past that pub. That was the second best, you know, the pubs don't move as much as the cows, so go up past the pub and take a left, and then you'll see the chicken pot pie pub, and then you go up, and then you see another pub, and that's how they would do it over there. But how can this small island, because it's small, how can it become a superpower that controls the world? In fact, it's said in here that it is astounding how you can take a few in the military, just a few, over millions of people and control them in the most efficient way, spending very little money. But they did, and they did it around the world. And sometimes we think back of the sun never set on the British Isles or on the superpowers of the British or the colonies of the British Isles, and it's true. But they can't understand. In this book here, it's on page 47. I guess I have to go back a few pages. The question was, how did the British do it? How in the first place did a peripheral island rise from primitive squalor to world domination? You know, when the Romans were over there, the British were nothing. You read the history, and they weren't powerful, they weren't great, and they just rose and became this world power. And he goes on to say, well, it wasn't because of them being supermen. They weren't more intellectual, more intelligent than anybody else. They really didn't have more drive than anybody else. There were other countries that had just as much drive. They just couldn't figure it out. He goes on with all types of ideas of why the British were so great. Let's go to Genesis chapter 49. Genesis 49. And here in Genesis 49, we will see what would take place in the latter days. In the latter days would mean, you know, toward or not too long before the coming of Jesus Christ. And we're looking at a period of time, actually, where when the world was used to Gentile domination, you know, based on the prophecy in Daniel that the Gentiles would rule, the times of the Gentiles would be extant till the return of Jesus Christ, except for a couple short periods, from the time of the captivity of Israel in the beginning, all the way up to the return of Jesus Christ. Overall, you have a Gentile domination, don't you? It is not Israel. So here in the latter days, it says, verse 1, Jacob called his sons and said, gather together that I may tell you what shall befall you in the latter days. And then you come down to the answer that is being asked concerning how in the world did the British do it. You come down to verse 22. Joseph. Now we know Joseph had two children, Ephraim and Manasseh. Joseph is a fruitful bough, a fruitful bough by a well. His branches run over the wall. The archers have bitterly grieved him, shot at him, hated him, but his bow remained in strength. And the arms of his hands were made strong by the hand of the mighty God of Jacob. There's the key. The only reason the British did so well is because they were made strong by God himself. Then it says, from there is the shepherd, the stone of Israel. Verse 25. By the God of your father who will help you, and by the Almighty who will bless you with blessings of heaven above, blessings of the deep that lies beneath, blessings of the breast and of the womb, the blessings of your father have excelled the blessings of my ancestors. Up to the utmost bound of the everlasting hills they shall be on the head of Joseph and on the crown of the head of him who is separate from his brothers. So you have two that are separate from his brothers. Of course, Joseph was separated when they sold him into Egypt. And that's, I believe, what he's referring to here. But overall, when you take a look at the tribes of Israel, you see that there's those two that had their name placed on them, that is Jacob's name placed on those two, when he blessed them. Let my name be on them, he said. And that's why today when you hear of, as we'll take a look at in a few moments, the times or the troubles of Jacob, is basically on those two, on Ephraim and Manasseh. You take a look at Ephraim, and some have thought that maybe they're just the one nation, but they're the nation that has colonized to spread out through the entire world and has become a multitude of nations. The United States has 50 states, but we're not a multitude of nations. And if you take a look at the United States and look at a comparison of the United States and the geography, the rivers, the land and what it produces, there is no country like it in the world. we are just an absolutely amazing country. Now, you do have the Soviet Union, and you have these countries that have at their disposal silver and gold and minerals of all types, but they don't have the transportation system that we do. They can't get it out. We have the best transportation system in the world as far as an economy is concerned. And that's all given to us by God. You can read the history by some, not our own history, but by others. I forget what source it was, but it was a few years ago. I pulled the article out, but it was someone not religious at all who was talking about the United States and the blessings that we have here in the United States. So, going on in Genesis 49, we can understand why, and coming back to the main point of the sermon, first of all, and that is, why was Great Britain, not so great maybe now, but why were they destined not to be in the European Union? Why were they destined not to be there? So I have 5 points here. Maybe I should give all my points, because sometimes I go through the points and someone says, now what was that 5th point or what was the 4th point? So the 1st point is Ephraim is a part of Israel separate from the final 10 nations of Europe. Separate from the final 10 nations of Europe. I'll go into that for a few moments. Number 2 point will be the time of Jacob's trouble demands Great Britain to be separate. Time of Jacob's trouble demands it. Number 3, when you look at Revelation 17, you see that the beast of the 10 nations bring trouble to Ephraim. We'll see that in the book of Hosea, which is mostly about Ephraim. The beast and 10 nations bring trouble to Ephraim, so they can't be a part of Europe. Number 4, Britain's weaknesses open the door for Germany to become a superpower by the fact that they won't be able to intervene. They've always done it in the past. By the fact they won't be able to intervene will bring on a superpower. If they were there, connected, they would have the influence. And as this Anthony Nutting said, we would be the leaders. If we would have not miss that bus, we would have been the leaders. And then point number 5, the European Union began in order to neutralize Germany. That's why it began. And it's not going to be neutralized. There's not going to be a Britain around. So these points tie in one to the other. It's not that they're just separate points. So number 1, Ephraim is Israel, part of Israel, separate from the final 10 nations of Europe. We think of the Brexit, and I believe in an article, oh, that was by Mr. Eddie Johnson, I think, that he pointed out in the article, and I believe this was brought up this morning in a sermon that read a Life, Hope, and Truth article. But they were looking some time ago at a smaller, or the question was, when are we going to have a smaller group? 28 countries are too big. We have to have a smaller group. So we see then there have to be countries that exit. The Swexit, is that what they're calling it? Sweden exiting? France could exit. I don't know that they will, because Germany and France seem to be like this. Why would you have a couple Israelite countries in Europe? Well, in Genesis 49, you see that Reuben was kind of cast out from the beginning. Genesis 49, in verse 3, Reuben, you are my firstborn, my might and the beginning of my strength, the excellency of dignity and the excellency of power, unstable as water, you shall not excel. What did the French do at the beginning of World War II? Well, they basically fell in with, they wouldn't like to hear it this way, but they basically fell in with the Germans and went along. Some say that the French were just as guilty as the Germans in putting the Allies, Allied peoples, to death. But they have always been a little bit separate. De Gaulle, by the way, did not want the British as part of the Union in the beginning. He was completely and totally against the British. And I forget what he said. I don't know if I kept that quote. Let's see here. Oh, yes. He said, if I remember it right, I just have a little note here, but he said he was against them because he thought if the British were part of the European Union, then they would bring over the Americans and they would be spies within the European Union who would bring down the Union. So de Gaulle did not trust the British. He knew we were like this with the Americans, or better yet, the British were like this with the Americans. But anyway, that's Reuben for you. Reuben is kind of on the outs. And for them to be part of the Union would not be a total surprise at all. I think they make some of the best jets, fighter jets in the world. If you look at, what is the name of the periodical that comes out periodically? Janes. There we go. It's a woman's name, Janes. That's it. Yeah, look at Janes, and it gives you the weaponry of all the major nations of the world. And it's amazing when you look at the Middle East, when you look at Europe, when you look at France, when you look at Germany, when you look at Saudi Arabia and Egypt, at the arsenal that they have. It's very worthwhile when you look at that. So you have Reuben. They could stay. Dan. It's interesting what it says in Genesis 49 about Dan. Going down to, let's see, verse 16, Dan shall judge the people as one of the tribes of Israel. Dan shall be a serpent by the way, a viper by the path, that bites the horse's heel so that the rider shall fall backward. There is actually a flag that you can find. It's a little hard, but it shows a serpent. And this is having to do with the British and the Irish, and it shows a serpent biting the heels of a unicorn, which is quite interesting. Again, it's hard to find that flag because you don't just see it normally. But it says in Dan, oh yes, verse 18, I've waited for your salvation, O Lord. So they haven't really been a part of the group either. Dan is, we think, very, very Catholic. And they're more in with the beast power initially, perhaps. We'll just have to see than any of the other Israelite countries. Okay, point number two. The time of Jacob's trouble, you go to Jeremiah 37. That is chapter 30 and verse 7. Jeremiah 30 and verse 7. And it says the following. Jeremiah 30 and verse 7. Alas, for that day is great, so that none is like it, and it is a time of Jacob's trouble, but he shall be saved out of it. Now, what it's telling us there is that there is no trouble that has been like what's coming in the future. It's the worst trouble that any country's ever been in. It has not happened yet. So it is the time of Jacob's trouble. And you go to Genesis 48, I'll just give the scripture here, Genesis 48 verse 16 that you can mark down. It talks about Jacob crossing his arms and knowingly blessing the youngest with the best blessing, the biggest blessing, the multitude of nations, that's Ephraim, and then blessing Manasseh with also a tremendous blessing. But he said, let my name be named on them. So you have then the time of Jacob's trouble, where you have, at the end time it would be, the beast and the 10 nations that come against those two nations, plus maybe some other Israeli nations too. But you cannot have Great Britain fighting itself, can you? They have to be separate from the beast power and the 10 nations that go along with the beast. Point number three, Revelation 17. I told you these kind of fit together. Revelation 17, the beast and 10 nations bring trouble to Ephraim. And this is where we go to the minor, so-called minor book called Hosea. And of course, it's the first one mentioned of the minor prophets. Hosea, and let me give you just a few verses here to show you what's happening with Ephraim. And we know that there's a duality in Scripture, that there is a time where this could have happened initially, as it did, and then a final fulfillment in the latter days. In chapter 4, verse 17 through 19, chapter 4, 17 through 19, Ephraim is joined to idols. Let him alone. Their drink is rebellion. They commit harlotry continually. Her rulers dearly love dishonor. The wind has wrapped her up in its wings, and they shall be ashamed because of their sacrifices. Ephraim is a nation that has forgotten their God. And if any of you have been to England, as I was back in 1965 and 66, it was a nation known to be way ahead of the United States in immorality. In fact, if you picked up a newspaper back then, it was more like your Inquirer of today, where the stories are all, you know, like this couldn't be real. And it was a nation known also to be completely immoral compared to the United States. They have, well, I think they're the ones that took a step beyond the United States and establishing evolution in their schools. So they have given up on God, so to speak, a long time ago. We had an article, I don't know if any of you remember a Plain Truth article where on the cover it said, "The Sick Man of Europe." Remember that? And that was Plain Truth magazine in black and white, maybe. I don't even know if it was color. So that would go back to 1961. It came out color, I think, when I came to college in 1962, maybe it was the first color. Maybe 63 or 4, somewhere right in there. Chapter 7, verses 8 and 9. Ephraim has mixed herself among the peoples. Ephraim is a cake unturned. Aliens have devoured his strength, but he didn't know it. When you hear the prognosticators talk about the economy, the future economy of England, and they say, well, temporarily it's going to maybe be a little troublesome, but they're going to come out of it. And then you read Scripture, it's like, no, they're in trouble. They absolutely are. They don't know how weak they are. Now, maybe it's going to be fairly easy at first rather than fairly hard, and then it's going to get tougher. But whatever the case, it's not going to be a blessing that they left the Union. They have been so anti-God that God is not going to bless them. God has stopped blessing them. And it's not that Europeans want to get rid of them. They don't want to attack them. Even Hitler did not want to get rid of the jewel or the crown, I think he called it, the crown of pearls over there. He did not want to destroy England completely. He did not want to do that. That's why he wasn't going to push, I guess, that the forces come in. If they could dominate through the blitzkrieg of their very proud general who thought that just send the planes over there and we can destroy England, they'll give up. That of course didn't happen. But Hitler didn't want to completely just devastate that island. He didn't. It's going to be destroyed eventually. Verse 9, aliens have devoured his strength, but he doesn't know it. Gray hairs are here and there on him, yet he does not know it. And the pride of Israel testifies to his face, but they do not return to the Lord their God nor seek him for all of this. So it's downhill. There's never going to be another British. Well, since World War II, the end of World War II, they've been losing their colonies. And I believe it started then. They made a mistake of not having Churchill for their prime minister again. They were not comfortable with being uncomfortable. That's what it was. They didn't want to have to go through all of these problems again. They had done enough suffering over there. Chapter 9 and verse 16. Chapter 9 and verse 16. Ephraim is stricken. Their root is dried up. They shall bear no fruit. Yes, were they to bear children, I would kill the beloved fruit of their womb. So again, you say, God is against them. And when God's against a nation, they're not going to come back. Chapter 5 and verse 13. Chapter 5 and verse 13. Tells us what they're going to do. And maybe they already did this. I'm not sure how this fits in. But chapter 5 and verse 13, notice what it says. How did I get to Daniel? Turn back too far, I would say. Hosea 5 and verse 13. When Ephraim saw his sickness and Judah saw his wound, then Ephraim went to Assyria. Now, either they did that in 1973 when they saw it would be maybe good to get into the Union after all. That could have been why they went to Assyria, so to speak. But they gave themselves over to them. And then at the end of verse 14, it says, I will take them away and no one shall rescue them. So either they did that already in 73 or they're out and they're going to want in again. Who knows? It was a 52-48% vote, I think. But whatever the case, it was interesting how all of this came about, too, how God does things. Cameron comes in office. He is very upset at the infighting, even in his own party, and he says, this is concerning being a part of Europe. And he says, let's get this over with. We'll call a referendum, and we'll see. The British people want to stay in it. We'll get rid of all this infighting over there, even in our own party, and now we can go on, and we can be part of the Union, and everything will be fine. Well, little did he know that they would vote to go out. And that's why he stepped down. He realized that that was his main goal when he got into office. Very much a pro-European. And the previous prime minister, the same way. He wanted to stay in the Union. But God deals in strange ways. And chapter 12 and verse 1, finally. Chapter 12 and verse 1. Ephraim feeds on the wind and pursues the east wind. They look to the east. He daily increases lies and desolation. Also, they make a covenant with the Assyrians, and oil is carried to Egypt. Now, what that means specifically, I don't know, except they're still trying to get out of trouble that they've gotten into. Have the oil reserves of the north, you know, the North Sea oils, we call them. Are they gone? Is that oil gone? Do they have to look to Egypt for oil? It's interesting what it says, but the main thing is they make a covenant with the Assyrians, and they already did, and who knows, maybe they again will try. Number 4, Britain's weaknesses opens the doors for Germany to become a superpower. In this book on page 46, it says, Italians badly wanted Britain in from the beginning for the same obsolete reasons. Okay, Britain's weakness opens the door for Germany to become a superpower is what I'm saying here. The Italians wanted the British in. They hoped it would counterbalance the political weight of France. And I think I may have mentioned that a few minutes ago. Since France was allied to the economic weight of West Germany, and Britain would guide all Western European nations as soon as possible towards some sort of federation or confederacy. Or better yet, France was going to do that along with West Germany, and they wanted Britain in there to counterbalance that, to avoid turning Europe into a third superpower. So I read that wrong at first. The Italians wanted the British in there to keep the West Germans. Remember, at this point in time, 1983, there was only West Germany and East Germany. They hadn't come together yet. That wasn't until 88, 89, was it? Somewhere in there. And again, they wanted to keep problems from happening. Well, they're too weak. They're no longer a part of the Union. They can't come in with any powerful force and stop a superpower anymore. They can't do it. When the 10 nations join with the beast, Britain is off to the side. They can't intervene anymore. And page 60, there's one more quote that I thought I would use here. It says, when Great Britain finally joined the common market, disastrously, too late, too expensively, at the wrong moment, they did so reluctantly and somewhat squeamishly, though politely, concealing their feelings, like decayed aristocrats obliged to adverse circumstances to eat in a soup kitchen for the needy. They made it very clear that they did it because of force majeure, but they were ready to leave at the first opportune time. Major forces basically wanted them in, but they were ready to leave at any time. Again, they're very weak, they're out, and now a superpower is free to fulfill prophecy. Bottom line. Number five, European Union began in order to neutralize Germany. As I mentioned, strong enough to defeat the Soviet Union, weak enough to be kept in power by Luxembourg. The German problem is the main problem, and we'll see fitting into world prophecy here. We go to the end of the book, and I have read this section before. It's been maybe 2 years ago. But on page 266, it says, there cannot be a really united Europe without a common currency. Of course, now there is. And a common foreign policy, which now they are focused on putting together to a great extent. But above all, a common defense policy. This, in the 20th century, means nuclear weapons, space defenses. It entails a tangle of insoluble political problems among the member nations and of the superpowers, but the principal obstacle is the German problem. German dreams of national reunification. It says a unification of Europe without Germany would be impossible and pointless, but with Germany would entail the acceptance for all members of the German problem. That's how he basically ends the book. You can't get along with him. You can't get along without him. Now, I'm going to a Life, Hope, and Truth article here put out by Eric Jones just in the last day or two to finish. And this is point two, Germany's increasing global role. So we come way past 1983 when this book was published. You have a united Germany. You have a Brexit. The British are no longer there. You have Germany as the strongest economic power in Europe. And here's what this article says. He's quoting Foreign Affairs, first of all. Features a very interesting article titled Germany's New Global Role by German Foreign Minister Frank-Walter Steinmeier. This article describes how Germany has emerged as the most stable and powerful nation in Europe. Germany is not just the undisputed economic leader of Europe, but it is also becoming a bitter diplomatic player in global affairs. After World War II, individuals, world leaders, were scoffing at the idea that Germany could ever come back. They said that there's no way. It was divided into four quarters. And then, of course, there were two. And then all of a sudden, there was one. 1988, well, President Reagan was the one who got in there and really spoiled the Soviets and was responsible to a great extent, I believe, of bringing Germany together because of the way the Soviets crumbled, basically. But we have a Germany that is very, very strong. But after World War II, no one said that the Germans could come back. So if you were living then, and I know I'm talking to young people, not too many, but to some young people today, and you weren't around, but Germany being a strong force in the world is a given. And adults walking the street today, whether they know it or not, if you ask somebody on the street, they don't even know maybe where Germany is, a lot of people. Oh, yeah, isn't that that place up near Iceland or whatever? People don't know history. They've forgotten about World War II. On Veterans Day, you don't even see movies anymore. Zorro, Zorro is not even played anymore. You know, the Japanese, wasn't that the movie? The attack with the Japanese? Zorro, Zorro? Toro, Toro. Oh, Toro, Toro. Well, I was close. It's T-U-V-W-X-Y-Z. I was only seven letters off. Yeah. But you don't have those movies anymore. Nothing like we did before. And so you have a nation that has forgotten the lessons of World War II. And we can't forget we forget the lessons, and the problem repeats itself. That's what happens. So you have then a Germany that is the undisputed economic leader of Europe. And that would have been a major problem in 1953. Going down, it says, Germany has remained remarkably stable. Germany has maintained its economic strength throughout the global recession. Germany is taking a more assertive role in global affairs. Can you imagine that happened in 1960? It's like, no, we don't trust Germany. We don't want that to happen. Guess what? The United States is saying, have at it. Sure, yeah, you can do it. We don't want to spend the money. You guys can spend the money. In fact, we have someone that wants to become president who's saying exactly that. Do you think Mr. Trump would give license to the Germans to take over? Just do whatever you need to in Europe. You know, you take care of the problem, we're not going to. And the answer is sure. Yeah, he's one to say we're not going to spend our money. And we can all think, is that good or bad? This is why we don't get into politics, brethren, because we don't know what is best for America. In fact, if we were living at the time of Jefferson, did you know that there was no constitutional power that gave Jefferson any role in buying the Louisiana Purchase? He didn't have the authority to do that. In fact, John Quincy Adams comes along and says, we have to make an amendment now. We've done it, but we better make an amendment so it is now, it's legal. And the Jeffersonians, the Republicans were they, and the Federalists at the time, they're like, we don't need to. We just did it. We put the Constitution aside. So there's so many things that happen that God is in that we think, well, wait a minute, no, we can't do that. No, we can't have this guy in. We can't have that guy in. It's like, no, God is doing what he's going to do, despite which way we feel. But going on this last section here, Germany is showing signs of growing more comfortable with embracing a bigger military role, a gradual but distinct shift away from an instinctive pacifism that took hold in 1945 and a post-Cold War tendency to shrink the nation's military. And everybody in the world, well, not everybody, but so many are happy with it. And finally, the Germans have a white paper dealing its intention to boost its military role as it prepares to emerge as a key player with a responsibility to actively help shape the global order. Problems in the Middle East? Sure, we'll go down and help. Yeah, we can do that. And where do you think all the weapons of NATO are going to go? I think they're going to go into the hands of the Germans, our European friends. So anyway, we take a look at these things, and we want to step back when there's a world event that transpires, as it did last week with the Brexit, and take a look at prophecy and see the news of the world in light of what the Bible says. Because it is very important, and we must never forget it. The end of the age is coming quickly, we think. Maybe that's 20 years from now, we don't know. We have thought in the past that the end was near, and then everything slowed down. So we can't say, well, it's 5 years, 10 years off. We don't know. But we do know that as we look at world history in comparison to what the Bible predicted, that events are taking place They're moving ahead, maybe slowly, but they're moving ahead surely. And the prophecies of the Bible are surely going to come to pass. And brethren, we need to be ready. Let's always remember to watch ourselves so that we don't get caught up in the sins of this world and forget, because we will forget what God predicted would happen at the end time. We don't want to lose out on salvation. So let's make sure that we have a mindset to desire the coming of Jesus Christ soon.